Hey y'all, how's it going? Well, that's good. I'm Scott Horton. Welcome to my show. It's the Scott Horton Show. What's the matter with this thing? Yeah, it's libertarian foreign policy, mostly. That is opposition to it all. You could also just call it, it's Scott complaining and then Scott talking to people he's ostensibly interviewing. Or, you know, whatever. I don't know. You can call it what you like. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. So today on the show, I'm going to be talking to Phil Giraldi, Kevin Zeese, and Sandy Tolan. I'll probably let them say some things too. But Phil Giraldi, he's got a new piece. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. About the USS Liberty. That's what's cool about calendars and years, months being reused over and over again. We just, every 12 lunar cycles or so, we get to mention the Liberty again. Hey, look, everybody, the anniversary of the Liberty. Let's talk about it. Okay, good. Well, Phil Giraldi's going to be on the show today, and he's going to talk about it. You know, I got a bunch of clips about the Liberty. I should play my Liberty clips. Maybe at some point today I will. Liberty clips. Yeah, it was the Al Jazeera thing, man. They got, they had some good audio there. Are you sure you want me to shoot at that boat? Sure does seem to be flying a pretty big American flag. You damn right I say shoot at it. Keep shooting. That's in there. Phil Giraldi will be on about that, the USS Liberty. Do you know about that one? Oh, you don't know about the USS Liberty. Well, you know what? You might want to hang around and listen to what Phil Giraldi has to say about it. You'll think to yourself, that's interesting. Also, Kevin Zeese is going to be on the show, and I love Kevin, and but boy, is he some kind of progressive. Which means I agree with him on a lot of stuff, but also not on a lot of stuff. So, but one thing coming right out of the gate, of course, is that he and I are both opposed to the TPP thing. Him because of what's in it and whatever other reasons, I don't know. Me, just because I don't think the U.S. Congress or presidency should exist. And so, therefore, I'm opposed to anything that they do, any kind of trade agreement. It's certain to be nothing but corrupt. Whole thing's negotiated in secret, and it's at all of our expense. Jeff Tucker and I talked a little bit about it last night on Eye on the Empire. If you want to check that out, it's at liberty.me. It's on YouTube. But so I watched a thing with Kevin Zeese on The Real News about this, and apparently there are two or three different treaties all being pushed through at once or something. He's a real expert on it. So we'll have some agreements and disagreements, but we'll learn a lot. And have a chance to talk with our old friend Kevin, who, after all, is really great on a lot of things. He's even part of the comehomeamerica.us thing, which is, you know, our attempt to build a realignment, a coalition on the very most basic issues. Restore the Bill of Rights, repeal the empire. Simple as that. Right? So. Kevin Zeese will be on the show. And then also Sandy Tolan. I don't know much about his background. I guess he must be some kind of progressive or something. But he's written quite a bit about Palestine. A couple of books, actually. And then, but I guess he's a musician. So he's taken an interest. And I'm not a musician. And I don't have, that much of an interest. So maybe I won't know real good questions to ask him along these lines, really. But, so he's followed young Palestinian musicians and is trying to tell their story. And written a couple of books, and here he's written a thing at Zocalo, with a C, not a K, zocalopublicsquare.org. But you don't need that. Just search Sandy and a Musical Intifada in the West Bank. And he'll be on to talk all about the occupation there and what it's like, you know, to humanize the Palestinians a little. I know that this is stupid and crass. That's the point. So don't think I'm stupid and crass for bringing it up. I'm saying I think that's maybe why it's important. Palestinians need better logos on their T-shirts, man. They need American fashion brand logos on their T-shirts. Even if it's like, you know, DC shoes or kind of whatever sort of so-called alternative culture type things or whatever. And a lot of times you'll see them and they'll have, you know, I mean, Palestinians, they don't wear burkas and robes and all this crap. They dress like Westerners anyway. But I just think they need more current brand names. Somebody needs to create a foundation to get, you know, all the most current shirt logos that all the high school kids love, and to hunt those things down at the Goodwill and then send all those off to Palestine as fast as possible. And then show the American people that the West Bank is not a bird's eye view shape on a map. It's a place with people, and look at them. They're just like you. That kid right there, doesn't he look just like your best friend from the neighborhood? Of course he does. Real people, this is how they live. And that's the thing about the Palestinians to the Americans is they hardly exist at all. Because they're not shown to us very often. That's really the thing. Not very often at all. So I think that's part of Sandy Toland's thing too is, wow, listen to this girl play this beautiful music. If only people could hear this. They might think, wow, why should she have to live under a foreign government's martial law her entire life and then die? Maybe likely killed by them. That doesn't seem right. Seem right to you? Doesn't seem right to me. Huh. What if she couldn't play the violin? Maybe she'd still have rights. I don't know. Just trying to draw your attention. That's the point. All right. And, yeah, I don't know. So that's the show today. Phil on the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty. Kevin Zeese on fascist, corporatist, imperialist government trade agreements coming down. And Sandy Toland on the occupation of the Palestinians in the West Bank. All right, cool. And then also, I got some news. I got a ton of Islamic State news. I don't have any Islamic State guests today. I was trying to get Mitch Prothro, but maybe I'll push that off till tomorrow. He wrote a real good write-up of the one-year anniversary of the rise of the Islamic State kind of thing in McClatchy that's worth looking at. Not that it's all-encompassing, but it's pretty broadly encompassing. All right, now check this out, guys.
Do I have time?
I think I have time. Maybe. Yeah, check it out. Y'all want to win a free vacation to the jungles of Costa Rica this summer and help support the Scott Horton Show? You can. Joshua Hughes, peace activist and permaculturalist, runs Verde Energia Pacifica, an intentional community in the mountains of Llanos de Puriscal, Costa Rica, and he's offered to raffle off a week's stay to listeners of this show. Airfare is on you, but transportation to and from the airport, as well as a 7-day stay for you and a guest in your own private house with 3 meals a day is covered. You can learn and practice some skills, or just go for a swim in their river, pool, or waterfall, walk jungle trails, enjoy the views, do yoga or dance in the studio, make art, play music, check out a local soccer game, or simply relax in a hammock by the river and read. Raffle tickets are just $50. Stop by scotthorton.org/raffle for details. And anyone who enters will get half off on any future stay down there. scotthorton.org/raffle. Yeah, cool. Got some tickets sold. The orders are coming in. So hurry up, sign up, get your name on the list, win a trip to Costa Rica. I'll have more details. I'm trying to get some good pictures of the place to post on the blog there. But, yeah, and I realize it's already almost the middle of June here, and we got to do this thing pretty quick in order for you to be able to even go on vacation if you win. So we're working on that. That probably just means you got real good chances because we're going to have to do the drawing sooner than later, right? So hurry up. Go to scotthorton.org/raffle. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code SCOTT when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, y'all, run out and get a copy of Embedded Alive, First-Person Journalism in the United States of America, 2013 through 14 by Chris Braswell. The book takes a gonzo look at daily life in America. Columns, informational letters, and other marketplace vigilance, a look at drug abuse culture and its marketing, and a series of contemplative and metaphysical essays. Get Embedded Alive, First-Person Journalism in the United States of America, 2013 through 14, in paperback, hardcover, and digital formats at fusepowder.com. Yeah, hey, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Look at my website, scotthorton.org. I keep all my blog, archive, music, what the, not music, interview, you know, audio, archives. That's the word I'm looking for. Well, I had the word music right in front of my eyeballs, and so it pushed its way to the front of the line. Anyway, yeah, I keep all my archives there, and you can join up the chat room if you want. scotthorton.org/chat. By the way, and I need to say this more often, you can support this show on Patreon now. Of course, I accept PayPal donations, whatever you can, whenever you feel like. Or you can do a monthly donation, subscription type thing there. And then, of course, I also accept Bitcoins. You can find that all at scotthorton.org/donate. But then now I'm also on Patreon. And at Patreon, the way it works is it's per thingamajig. So the way I've done it is I'm asking for nothing. You name your price. I assume you'd want to start pretty low at for per interview, whatever these interviews are worth to you, however much you think you're willing to pay for them. So you could keep in mind there's about 80 of them a month or something. So I don't know. Why not sign up to chip in 2 bits per interview? Especially if, you're the kind of person who never hears this because you listen only to the interview podcast, the interview archive podcast. Anyway, whatever. If you want to support the show, patreon.com. I know I need to say that at the beginning of interviews, at the end of interviews. And also, we got transcripts now. I know I need a link up at the top of the page, scotthorton.org/transcripts. And say if you hear an interview that you think is really good, you can order a transcript of it. And I know I need to work that into my shtick, too, when I say, hey, that was Professor McCoy, Alfred McCoy. Get a transcript of this interview at scotthorton.org/transcripts. I need to start doing that. It's a habit I got to get into. Like starting smoking. I've done a terrible job so far, but yeah. That's the thing though. $2.50 for a transcript. Come on, that's a good deal. You should buy transcripts of interviews that you want transcripts of. That's what I think. All right. And then, yeah, I just wanted to complain real quick, and I guess this will come up in the Tolan interview, but I think that the American people have no idea that the West Bank and Gaza Strip are occupied territory. I think they just don't know. I think TV never shows people a map and says, so this part is Israel, and this part is Palestine, but all of it's ruled by Israel. And these people here, here, and here, boy, are they on the outclass, man. You know, if the Palestinian Israeli citizens are second-class citizens, what does that make the people of the occupied West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem? It makes them prisoners. And, you know, I think, I don't know who I'm plagiarizing here. I'm not claiming I made it up, but, I know who it was. It was good old, what's his name? Noam, not Chomsky. Noam Shizoff from the 972 mag wrote a thing in Slate one time saying, basically that he's an Israeli, a peacenik Israeli. And he's saying, well, the West Bank is like a minimum security prison in East Jerusalem, I guess. And the Gaza Strip is a maximum security prison. That's the difference. That's the context that Americans need to understand. And that's why they never tell you the truth of it. Because the thing of it is, in major media, I think they recognize that if they said, look, here are the simple facts of who's occupying who, whose side are you on? Americans, even though we are the overlord, you know, very loose definition of we there, forgive me, poetic license. We like to pretend we're the underdog. We like to pretend we side with the underdog. We like to pretend every time we invade and conquer someone, it's like that time we liberated France from the Nazis and this kind of crap. But so, I think if TV ever said to the American people, look, here's a map. Here's who's lording it over who. Oh, they've just been fighting over that land for centuries, implies that it's some kind of equal anything. And I'm not saying that pre-67 borders is perfectly fine. I agree with the American government in the first place that Truman shouldn't do it. Right? All the rest of the permanent government said, oh no, this is going to be a disaster. The creation of Israel as a Jewish state instead of a multi-ethnic one in the first place. But, you know, within 67 borders, at least, just amorally speaking, never mind the refugees and whatever, just for argument's sake, seems like that was at least a sustainable project. But as Jeff Tucker was saying on the show last night on Eye on the Empire, once they occupied and decided they wanted to take the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, now what are they going to do? You know, the Nakba and the war, they got away with that all right in the context of the creation and the and a war, you know, under the guise of a war with the foreign countries, too, that jumped in back in 48. But there's, I don't know, I don't want to, like, encourage them or anything. It doesn't seem like it's possible in global politics now for them to really force march all of the Palestinians out of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip into Jordan or into the river or into the Sinai Peninsula or Egypt from Gaza. They're just going to keep them there. They're just going to occupy them forever. They're just keep creating facts on the ground and facts on the ground. And, you know, eventually there won't be a farmer with a crop to sow left. Everyone will have a wall between themselves and their livelihood, and then I guess they'll just lay down and die. Yeah, take their time. And now the whole thing is they're hurrying up because, of course, Netanyahu's government is made up of people who are even all to the right wing of him, religious and secular and otherwise. They're all hardcore right wing nationalists who, if you think he won't give up for a Palestinian state, none of his coalition will stand it. If he wanted to do it, he couldn't at this point give up the West Bank. They say annex it and then still give no rights, you know, recognize no rights of the people who live there. It's crazy. And it's all on the American people's dime and all under the American Empire's protection. And if the American people had any idea, they would be against it. If Americans knew, right? That's what's her name's website? If Americans knew. If Americans knew, it wouldn't be like this. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting her name all of a sudden. The lady from the Council for the National Interest. That was her thing. I saw a speech she gave where she said she was doing the Save the Children thing. You send two pennies a day for the cost of a cup of coffee, you can save a little kid. You know, all that stuff, like on TV, Sally Struthers and all that. She signed up for that. And the kid that they gave her was a Palestinian refugee living in a camp in Lebanon or in Syria. And that was how she learned about the plight of the people who used to live where Israel is now and got interested in this thing. So I'm not asking for bias. I'm just asking for the straight truth. I think if you just show people a map, show them who's really in charge of what, ask them, what if it was the other way around and the Palestinians occupied the Israeli Jews this way? How they'd feel about that? I think things would change real quick. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest on the show today is our friend Phil Giraldi. He's a former CIA and DIA officer, and now he is the executive director of the Council for the National Interest, and he writes for the American Conservative Magazine and UNZ.com. That's UNZ, UNZ.com. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm fine, Scott. How about you?
I'm doing great. Hey, you wrote an article, and it's at UNZ.com. It's called "The USS Liberty Must Not Be Forgotten." Yeah, well, what about those people who never heard of it in the first place? Tell them.
You know, that's funny. There was, you know, there were about 50 of us there for this commemoration because it was the 48th anniversary of the attack. And we had like a tour guide bus from Arlington Cemetery that drove us out to the area where the memorial was located. And she didn't know anything about the Liberty. And it was just like a complete mystery to her, and we had to explain it. And yet she was a girl that could tell you in detail who was buried in each one of the, you know, 48 different sections of the cemetery. Mm-hmm. So it's funny. It supports exactly what you're saying, that there's been a deliberate attempt or certainly a successful attempt to make people forget about the Liberty.
Right. Yeah. In other words, For that job, she had to really study and be trained very well to be expert in who's buried where, and that is just such a glaring omission. It must be deliberate. There was a conversation that said, no, we're not doing that.
You know? Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's been, you know, right from the start. I was a junior in college when the attack took place, and I remember right from the beginning how the media was kind of playing this up as, no, it couldn't possibly be the Israelis, blah, blah, blah. And then the story kind of went away. And of course, the White House, assisted in that process by making sure there was no after the fact investigation, that there was no public awarding of medals for those who had been wounded and so on and so forth. So, you know, this was kind of a story that was, born to die.
Yeah. Yeah, from even in the middle of the dang thing, and this is the very worst part. I'll go ahead and skip right to it. Fighter jets were dispatched, and the President of the United States himself, Lyndon Baines Johnson, ordered them to turn back.
Yeah, that's correct. Lyndon Baines Johnson instructed Robert McNamara, who was Secretary of Defense at the time, to have the jets recalled. And there are also some apocryphal stories around that, too, that apparently one of Johnson's staff heard him say something to the effect of, I don't care if that damn ship sinks to the bottom as long as it doesn't embarrass our friends.
Unreal. All right, so, yeah. All right, stop, hold it right there, rewind, go back. What's the USS Liberty? What's it doing in what sea, and how did it get bombed, and by who, and everything?
Okay, the USS Liberty was an intelligence gathering ship. It was an old Liberty ship from Second World War vintage that had been refitted with intelligence antennas and gear, and it had translators on board, and it had various intelligence types as the crew. And it was attacked on June 8, 1967, by Israeli forces. It was in international waters at the time. It was clearly marked as a United States naval vessel with a huge American flag. And the Israelis basically attacked it from the air and then came in with torpedo boats to finish the job. And due to the efforts of the crewmen who survived the attack, they kept the ship afloat, and it eventually made it back to Malta for repairs. 34 sailors were killed. 171 more were wounded. This was the most significant toll on one ship since the Second World War, and it was also the most significant attack on a U.S. naval vessel ever in peacetime. So it was this was a major attack. The captain whose name was McGonagall, was awarded the Medal of Honor, but Lyndon Johnson would not even present it to him. Normally, Medals of Honor are presented in the White House by the president. He refused to do it, and he had his Secretary of the Navy do it in a secret session with no press at the Washington Navy Yard. So that was the cover-up we're talking about that took place after the Liberty incident occurred.
Yeah. Well, President Johnson was terribly upset at the captain's treason for saving his own life and those of the crew that he was responsible for. He was supposed to die that day, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, here we have Lyndon Johnson, who was the legend of Lyndon Johnson, the dirt poor farmer from Texas who became a multimillionaire after a life in politics and had a lot of vested interests with people with money and a lot of interests of all kinds. And he wasn't going to allow a bunch of sailors to get in the way of his more compelling friendships. So this guy, as I said in my article, I hope this guy is burning in hell. Mm. Together with McNamara. You know, it's one thing to play the political game in terms of who your friends are and so on and so forth. It's another thing to kill American soldiers and seamen or American civilians as you're pursuing your own agenda. That is just totally unacceptable.
All right. Now, I know the argument goes that, hey, man, come on. Speaking of McNamara, of course, especially, it's the fog of war, Phil. There's a lot of war fog. And these guys were in the middle of the Six-Day War, right, against Egypt and Syria. And, well, something must have gone wrong, and they accidentally bombed the Americans. Why would the Israelis, our good friends, ever bomb us deliberately? You must be confused, sir, huh?
Well, that's the part of the story nobody knows the answer to, or at least no one has come through with a compelling answer. Why would they do it? There are a couple of different stories that have been floated. One of them was that that the Liberty had intercepted. They had Hebrew interpreters, too, on the ship, incidentally. They interpreted messages to indicate that the Israelis were about to occupy the Golan Heights. Another story was that the Israeli army had 500 Egyptian prisoners, and they shot them dead. And they didn't want – that's a war crime. They didn't want this story to come out. Those two accounts are not particularly convincing. Whatever the motivation was, it was a clear attack by the Israeli military on a recognized U.S. warship. One of the Israeli pilots – the NSA was, you know, listening in on communications. One of the Israeli pilots said, "Hey, that's an American ship. I'm not going to attack it." And he peeled off. So, you know, it was clear that this was an American vessel that was under attack.
Right. And now I actually have a folder here, and I guess probably after this interview, I don't have any more segments. Well, maybe on a later show I'll play this audio, but there was an Al Jazeera special that they did about a year ago where they have a lot of this audio, you know, translated of the soldiers clearly recognizing that this is an American vessel and asking their commanders, "Are you certain you want me to bomb these guys?" And being told, "Yeah, you heard me. Get back to it." Just kind of, you know.
Yeah. So there's no question about it. And the fog of war is just kind of an excuse so you don't have to blame the Israelis. And you know, but all right, fine. I understand what, you know, how the process works and everything like that. They can, whenever a U.S. naval vessel is attacked or seriously damaged, they have to convene a court of inquiry. They did convene one, and it was headed by Admiral John McCain, the senator's father. And he instructed the court that basically they were going to come back with a finding of it wasn't deliberate. And they had like 1 week to prepare, whereas normally a hearing like this takes 6 months. And that was the verdict that they wanted, and that came straight from the White House. And why we know this is because people that were part of this process, part of the inquiry, such as it was, later were so disgusted by what happened that they later, you know, basically described just how they had been railroaded.
Yeah. Well, you know, Ray McGovern has said on this show he was in the CIA at the time, and they all knew what was going on in real time then. There's no question about it, whether it was an accident or not.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now hold it right there. We'll be right back, everybody, with Phil Giraldi from UNS.com and the American Conservative Magazine right after this. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, guys, welcome back. Now, Fitz in the chat room is stealing all my thunder. I have to give him credit for all the things I was going to say anyway now. My questions for Phil. Two things. First of all, as though the Israelis don't know what each and every Egyptian military naval ship looks like, right? Which ones are where at any given time. They look at the USS Liberty bristling with antenna and, of course, the oversized American flag. But no, they're just confused and think that maybe that belongs to the Egyptians. But then he also raises the question of, I mean, is that even possible, first of all? But then also, secondly, he raises the question of motive of the false flag attack, that maybe if the ship had sunk, they would have successfully gotten away with saying that the Egyptians had done it and brought the Americans in the war to, I guess, just obliterate Egypt in the name of the liberty. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's another theory that's surfaced, and it is quite credible in some ways. It would not have necessarily led to obliterating Egypt, but it certainly would have led to the United States getting involved and probably, you know, supplying the Israelis with all kinds of weapons and intelligence and that kind of thing. No question about it. That theory is a viable one, that they basically wanted to sink the U.S. vessel. Clearly, they were trying to sink it. I mean, there was a 40-foot hole by torpedoes in the ship. It's a miracle it did not sink. And especially when Johnson called back the planes and the support, and there was a destroyer racing to the site too. When they were all called back, I mean, the ship, the likelihood the ship would sink was very, very high, like approaching 100%. And so it was a miracle it didn't sink. And if it had sunk, it would have been blamed on the Egyptians, no doubt about it. And with consequences, obviously, for politics in the Middle East and all kinds of other things you can imagine.
Right.
So that indeed is a very viable theory about why this was done.
And, you know, it sounds a little, oh, that's kind of conspiratorial, except remember the Maine and remember the Lusitania and remember the Gulf of Tonkin and the Maddox there, the pseudo-attack there. This is the tried and true way to get into a war.
Yeah, and the Israelis have tried things like this before. I mean, obviously, there was the Levant incident in Alexandria, mm-hmm. where they were going to blow up a British consular post and a U.S. information library and make it look like Nasserites, radical Egyptians, had been behind it. And again, the idea was to get the British and American governments in bed with Israel. So, I mean, this is something in their thinking. You can even cite the Levant as a precursor for this kind of thing.
Yep. All right. Now, so one of the benefits of doing this show for me, and one of the benefits of writing all the time about this stuff for you, is that we're on top of this stuff just as it comes out in real time. We can always refer back to our previous conversations and previous coverage. So there may be some people who are Johnny come lately to the America is backing Al-Qaeda in Syria story, except not you and me, because you've been writing about it and I've been interviewing you about it since 2011, when America and Saudi first decided they're going to hijack this Arab Spring and do a counter-revolution, exploit it where they could in Libya and in Syria, and clamp down against it everywhere else. As best they could. I guess there was kind of a pseudo-regime change there in Yemen. We saw how that worked out as well. But all through the summer of 2011 and that fall, we were talking about this, and then you came out with an article for the American Conservative Magazine The antiwar.com version was America's Secret Wars, and I always forget the name of the American conservative one. Phil, do you remember it? About the finding?
Anyway. 4 years ago, I hear you.
Yeah. Sorry. Well, I link to it every so often, so I'm sorry I'm spacing out. But anyway, you wrote it would have been December, the first week in December, maybe second week in December 2011, that Barack Obama had signed new findings authorizing covert action in Syria and Iran, and clearly that meant on the side of the rebels who already were dominated by the suicide bomber types as that was going on. So we've been covering this all along, the absolute absurdity of it and even the treasonousness of it on USS Liberty levels, actually, if you ask me. These people sworn to Ayman al-Zawahiri, who've been the beneficiaries of all our arms and weapons all this time. But so I've been dying to ask you what you think of the DIA report from now released from FOIA from Judicial Watch, Larry Klayman and Judicial Watch, the DIA report, August 2012, saying basically exactly what we were talking about on this show, that this policy is leading to the rise of a new state in eastern Syria and could lead to the rise of a state crossing that border and Al-Qaeda in Iraq taking over huge parts of Iraq, even creating that caliphate that used to just be part of George W. Bush and Osama bin Laden's imagination back in the day. And so what do you say?
It's as you say, you and I have been discussing this on and off for years now. And the problem with the United States is that they always have this idea that if you support one group, it doesn't have any impact beyond that. Or if you go after one group. So, I mean, it's the same argument. And the fact is that when you basically, for example, like we're talking about Syria, we're talking about Iraq, you invade Iraq or you basically support rebels against the regime in Syria, there are other people that are going to fill these vacuums. And they don't ever seem to get that. And that's exactly what we're talking about. I mean, today the beneficiary might be ISIS. Last week it might have been Al-Qaeda. They don't seem to get it that they are creating the conditions for the very horror stories that they're using to defend this kind of action. I can really not understand how all these smart people in Washington with all their intelligence resources and everyone that can't figure these things out. I also heard this morning, as I'm sure you did, that they're sending 400 more trainers to Iraq.
Yep.
I mean, do they want to hand them, you know, over a couple thousand more Hummers or a few more tanks? And what is the logic to all this kind of stuff? There's never any end game, and that's what really is disturbing about it.
Yeah. Well, and in fact, Obama said, "No, we don't have a strategy." Because the strategy depends on the Iraqi government, and of course the strategy is completely bogus, that they're going to put Humpty Dumpty back together again when it was America that broke it, and when the parties that America put in power in Baghdad are the very ones who wanted to split Iraq in three, the more Iran-loyal of the Shiite parties, the Dawa Party and the Supreme Islamic Council and their militias in the Badr Corps. They always wanted to just, thanks for the capital city, America, now get out and create their own little Shia stand. Not necessarily break Iraq up, but certainly not do anything to get along with the people in Fallujah, Ramadi, and Mosul. Screw them. That's been their policy
this whole
time.
What's interesting is watching what's going on with the Republicans right now, because they're all screaming about what's going on in Iraq, and we should have left troops there. Well, we couldn't leave troops there. The Iraqis basically kicked us out. Don't they remember that?
Yeah. The guys that we helped win said, thanks a lot for giving the capital city to us. Now get out.
Yeah, exactly. That's what they said. They said, we know you won't stay. You won't have any more bases in Iraq without a status of forces agreement, and we're not going to give you a status of forces agreement. That was an exit. Don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out.
Right. Yep. 56 bases? Nope, sorry. All right, so here's this DIA report from 2012. It says exactly what we were saying, which is, hey, I mean, and they even call it a danger. I don't think, I mean, they say, yeah, I guess this is sort of what we're trying to do in Syria, but it reads to me like, hey, boss, this could lead to all of Iraqi Sunnistan ending up, you know, finally completely breaking away from Iraq and then being under the sway of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, guys, and that's a real danger. They call it a danger in there.
Yeah.
And so really, You know, they're not that blind to it. At least their military intelligence advisors aren't that blind to the consequences. I mean, how right. could they be? In fact, Obama himself, this is Dan Sanchez's new article at antiwar.com. He's got great quotes. I have that great Hillary Clinton quote I always play, but he's got great quotes from Obama, too, from when Ben Swan cornered him about it and a couple of other reporters asked him about it in 2012, saying, yes, it's true. A lot of the rebels in Syria are terrorists who we do not want to end up arming. That's why I'm real squeamish about this, and that's why I'm telling Hillary no. Basically, I only want to give them some guns and not too many. So he has kind of been half-assing it because, as he said himself, he recognizes that the rebellion is basically led by a bunch of bin Ladenites. But yet yeah. he still persists. It's not like he has put the brakes on the project completely or done the slightest thing to stop, Turkey, Saudi, Qatar from, and Israel from continuing to back this policy of supporting the bin Ladenites.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But let me tell you a partial explanation for how this works is that in Washington, you have that DIA report, and that's working its way up through the system. And then as simultaneously with that, you have the guys who sit at the top of the system saying, this is what we want. And that works down in the system, and people forget about the DIA report. Everything that comes out of Washington, comes out of the top levels in Washington, is completely politicized and has as little connection with reality as a comic book. And that's unfortunately the way the whole thing works. I saw that repeatedly when I was in the agency, the political considerations ignored intelligence that was being developed on the ground when it wasn't something that they were comfortable with.
Yeah, well, and then still they persist. Stories come out every couple of weeks. Oh, yeah, we're training these guys. We're arming those guys. Susan Rice comes out and says, yeah, we have been sent a lot more lethal weapons than we said, not just non-lethal weapons. And they just continue on. And I made this joke to you before, but I think it's still true. A year later, Phil, it's still true that the Israeli lobby sway, and I guess the Saudi lobby too, I don't know exactly how it proportions out or whatever, but their political interests in Washington, D.C., those special interests, are so powerful that they've got our policy in the Middle East so divided that they prevented a much worse war, in effect. I mean, they created this situation, don't get me wrong, but I just mean, at this point, if it was cut and dry, well, look, the bad guys are the bin Ladenites, we're going after them, then that's what they'd be doing. But they can't do that because then they'd have to ally with Assad and outright ally with Iran, even though, like we talked about, they've been allied with the Iranian faction in Iraq all along, and they still are. But because the policy is so schizophrenic and nonsensical over there, it's actually prevented them, I think, from having a more clear-cut narrative about who the enemy is and what to do about it.
Yeah, because basically what they're doing is they're allowing a lot of competing interests to cut out parts of the pie, and that's how the whole process works. And where they wound up is they wound up in a situation where there's no exit, and that's the true tragedy here. If Obama tries to cut his losses and get out, he's going to have screaming from the Republicans and from the media, and so when the Republicans come in, they'll do another stupid surge, which will kill a whole bunch of people, and 6 months later it'll be back to normal.
Yeah. I mean, okay. So best case scenario, forget morality or cost or anything, but just like play imperialist for a minute. If you really wanted to send in the Marines or the army and destroy the Islamic State in Mosul, Fallujah, Ramadi, send in the B-52s to help soften those targets up, seems like it really could be done just mathematically, in terms of the firepower that the American military has. But is it even conceivable under those circumstances, under the best circumstances, that you could actually get rid of what, was Al-Qaeda in Iraq, is now the Islamic State, this group of guys? I mean, you could turn them back into an insurgency. Obviously, you could H-bomb the place. But short of that, is there anything that America could do other than simply occupying Mosul forever that would prevent this group or group just like it from coming back in? I'm not saying I would advocate for it, but I'm just trying to figure out, in the absolute best case scenario, fantasy of American power being able to deliver on its ends. I mean, is it even conceivable, Phil?
Well, I would give you a radical solution. The radical solution would be to empower the people who are the most powerful enemies of ISIS and al-Qaeda, and that would be the Syrian government and the Iranian government. We should enter into a de facto alliance with these people, whom we would be holding our nose while we do it, but we should be helping them to eradicate these people, ISIS and al-Qaeda.
Mm. Yeah, but then what about when all the Iranian militias and factions and special forces do their sectarian cleansing, like it seems like they've already accomplished in Tikrit, and start taking more and more territory for the Shiites, populating those towns as they force ISIS out. They force more people into ISIS as their only defense against the Iranian invasion.
Okay, but what you succeed in doing, and I'm speaking of a realpolitik on the part of the United States, is you're taking an international problem and you're making it a regional problem, and you're leaving it to the local players to take care of. That's nasty. A lot of people are going to get the chop. But the fact is, you know, we as a nation presumably have our own interests, which really have nothing to do with being on various sides in this conflict, which have done nothing but also kill a lot of people. So I would say, you know, it's we de-internationalize the problem by empowering the people and the Turks, if we could bring them into it, to deal with the problem, because it is a regional issue.
Man, I wanted to ask you all about the Turkish elections and the results and what all that means for Turkish support for al-Nusra and all this, but we're all out of time, Phil. But thank you very much for doing the show. Got to go, but sure do appreciate you coming on again.
Okay, Scott. All right, bye-bye.
All right, y'all, that's the great Phil Giraldi. He's at UNZ.com. That's UNZ, UNZ.com, and LouRockwell.com, L-E-W, Rockwell. No, he's not. I'm thinking of Margulies. UNZ.com and the American Conservative Magazine. That's what I meant to say, the American Conservative Magazine.com. Be right back. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, guys, you have to check the archives for the end of that Giraldi interview, because we went into the break there, because I'm just no good at going by the hard breaks, because I don't like to. Anyway. Next up, it's our old friend Kevin Zeese.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you? Welcome back.
Doing great, and happy to be on the show.
I was going to say from, and then I started thinking of this flood of URLs, and I wasn't sure which order to put them in, so I started stuttering.
Well, the one to emphasize at this point is for this show, is for this issue, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and these rigged corporate trade agreements, is Popular Resistance, popularresistance.org.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm actually talking to you from Capitol Hill. We're in the process of an occupation. Well, we're staying the night up here and staying up here until a critical vote. This Friday, it'll be over by 3. It's a vote on whether or not to fast-track these rigged corporate trade deals that are really crony capitalism on steroids. It's going to be a really close vote. It's going to be really interesting to see how it plays out. We're hearing such different reports from different news sources on how the votes are lining up. It's really interesting. So people need to take action. They want to stop, you know, this corporate coup, this big business coup. They should go to stopfasttrack.com. You can, from that, just put in your zip code, and they'll connect you with your member of Congress, so you can talk to them. And then I'd urge you to call other members of Congress as well, you know, nearby. Just let them know to vote no on Fast Track. There's a big revolt going in the grassroots, and the elites in Washington are trying to ignore it, but it's coming from both the right and the left. Breitbart has some great stories about the right side of this, the Republican grassroots, the Libertarian grassroots, the conservative grassroots that are just enraged over what they're calling Obama trade, And it's a whole secret deal where we don't get to see what he's negotiating. But they want to fast track it through Congress, so Congress can't hold any hearings. They can't make any amendments. They have to vote up or down in a very short amount of time, and really, you know, undermines democracy in order to pass a secret trade deal that is secret to all of us, but hundreds of Obama's friends who donate to his campaigns, big business interests, have been helping to write it. So it's a treaty written of by and for the big business interests, and it's definitely being against the people's interests. So we're trying to stop it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think this is a great clarifying issue here, and it really just goes to show, you know, the people on one side and power on the other side, and it doesn't matter if you're left, right, or, you know, a grassroots conservative, a grassroots liberal. And yeah. I know, you know, you guys tend to be kind of protectionist, but a libertarian 1,000% free trader like myself would be just as opposed to it as you, because this is fascism. Come on, man. This has nothing to do with democracy, and it has nothing to do really with free trade either. It's 10 million
trade.
Words long, is because it's all a bunch of corruption.
Exactly. Free is not what this is. This is not free. This is rigged trade.
Yeah, I even read an article in the American Prospect, which is, I guess, kind of the center-left Democratic Party liberal line, right? And they were saying, yeah, no, we'd support free trade, but this isn't that. So,
exactly.
And they're even, I guess, what you'd call neoliberals. And they're like, no, but not this.
Exactly. It really is a clarifier. You can see who the populists are. You can see who the elites are. You can see the answers to the big business. You can see the answers to the people. It gets really clear with this. And it's a really great opportunity to see what your elected official really stands for. Is he staying with you or staying with, you know, J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs and those kinds of, Halliburton-type corporations who are pushing this so aggressively? They've never seen up here. I mean, some of the members of Congress who oppose these rigged trade deals have never seen Obama work so hard to pass something. He is, like, working hard, and Paul Ryan, too. And as I said, check out these Breitbart articles. There's three of them now. Two came up yesterday, one came out today, that just describe how the Republican support on this is collapsing because the grassroots is pushing so hard. And I think one reason that the leadership pushed for the vote this Friday, even though they're not sure if they have the votes, is because they're afraid of the grassroots. They don't want members going home for the weekend and talking to people. They don't want another week of telephone calls. We did a phone call day last week, one day. This is from the left side. One day we had 60,000 phone calls into the U.S. House of Representatives. 60,000. Our friends who are working on the right side of this, the Republican side of this, they did a Twitter storm on Monday. It was a trending Twitter, not only nationally but globally. The grassroots is outraged by this idea of a secret trade agreement rushed through Congress with no real hearings, no hearings at all. They're outraged, and yet the elites ignore us. And this is a really great opportunity to put them in their place. I think we can win this vote, but people have to mobilize.
Yeah, man, I'm with you. So now, two things here. And I hope you'll be able to stay into the second segment too, right?
You're going to have to go. Life is busy, but
okay. Well, I'll let you go. I'll let you go if you needed to go. But so two things here, real quick, and we still got 4 or 5 minutes. So if you could please give me like a real crash course in the kinds of cronyism that are in here. You know, really teach me some stuff about what the hell is in this thing. Not just, you know, it's corrupt because Goldman supports it. I mean, that's simple enough. We could all just, you know, march right to Capitol Hill based on that alone, obviously. But why do they support it, really? And then secondly, convince me that my congressman gives a damn if I call him, too.
Well, the second question is the most important one. They do give a damn. You know, when NAFTA passed, that's when the Democrats lost control of the House. That's when Democrats lost their seats. This is an issue that cost them their jobs, and they are afraid of this massive grassroots tsunami. It definitely has an impact. There are many members of Congress who are coming out against this, who, you know, we just didn't know whether they would or not, and they're coming out against it. Others, we have a place on Capitol Hill we're occupying where they have to walk back and forth between the House office buildings and the Capitol building. Some of them will just, like, we ask them, where do you stand? They won't say. What's your name? They won't say. They don't want anyone knowing. They're so embarrassed by what they're doing and so afraid of it. They won't even want to talk about it in public. They just don't want the pressure. So they're afraid of people. So I do think it makes a difference. I know it's hard to even believe in our oligarchic government, but there is a power in people who are mobilized the way that this movement is. We have the largest ever grassroots movement on the left on this, covering food and water and banking and labor and environment. I mean, every issue that you care about is affected by these trade agreements because they're so broad. Basically, what these trade agreements are so bad about them is, you know, things that they can't get through the front door of Congress, as corrupt as Congress is. Things they can't get through the corrupt Congress through the front door, these big business interests, are shoving in the back door here. And that's why they're keeping it secret. The reason, you know, the fact that it's secret is a clue as to why, you know, you're on, you know, the people on the wrong side of this, on this agreement. They're doing things like creating these evergreen patents so that pharmaceuticals can keep their prices high. A 20-year patent, and if you just change the formula, you know, by going from a gel to a liquid or saying it's no longer just a headache, but also for a stomach ache, you get another 20-year patent. And any generic drug that wants to come on the market has to redo all the research. They cannot rely on the research done by the pharmaceutical company. So it keeps prices of drugs artificially high just to create profits for an already way too abusive of their clout pharmaceutical industries. That's just one example how it'll affect our pocketbooks. They're expanding the patents not just to pharmaceuticals. They also want to change patents to cover surgical and other medical procedures. So if you want to use a procedure, you have to pay for it now. Right now, there's no such thing as paying for a procedure, a patent on a procedure. They want to change it to do that. I mean, they want copyrights of books to last 120 years for a textbook. I mean, so it's insane. I mean, they're just giving everything that corporate, plus they have these trade tribunals that will basically destroy our court system. A trade tribunal where the judges are three judges from corporate power, you know, corporation on leave from their corporate job. They make a decision, then they go back to their corporate job. These decisions by trade tribunals can't be overturned by our Supreme Court. They are more powerful than our Supreme Court. So they are undermining the third branch of government completely with this. And, of course, Fast Track itself, I think, undermines the constitutional responsibility of Congress, which under the Commerce Clause, Article 1 of the Constitution, Congress is said to be responsible for regulating trade between nations. They are giving that power to President Obama. And so that to me is undermining of the separation of powers and the requirement that trade between nations be regulated by Congress, not by the president. So those are just a few examples. I find this to be a total transformation of an already weak democracy to a much weaker one. These are all anti-democratic provisions, anti-constitutional, really undermine the whole judicial system.
Right. Popularresistance.org, stopfasttrack.com. Okay, I can keep interviewing you for a second. I just want to make sure live audience got to hear that one more time before we went into the break.
All right, we appreciate
it. Sorry to cut you off so soon there, but thanks very much for coming back on the show.
Thank you
very much. Really appreciate
you, Kevin. Appreciate it. All right, bye-bye.
Okay, that's Kevin Zeese, y'all, popularresistance.org, and again, stopfasttrack.com. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. One thing about Twitter is you never run out of people who love cops and love it when cops kill people. And love to assume that, well, of course, they must have had to. What more do you need to know? First of all, Your Honor, just look at them. Even though, and of course, yeah, they're private criminals who can be as dangerous as a cop at times. You know, I'm not saying that that's not true or whatever, but I don't know. I don't think that anywhere near most police shootings are justifiable. Happen all the time. It's just as easy to find from examples of real tough murderous criminals. It's just as easy to find examples of cops deliberately escalating a conflict so that they have an excuse to kill somebody. You can even find the Ferguson cop who wrote that in the Washington Post. Says, yeah, oh no, now me and my partner, we're not like this. But the rest of these cops, man, if they're in any kind of violent situation, they will do what they can to provoke, to escalate, until the point even where deadly force is required. You know, after you smash enough teeth out with your elbow, it's just not satisfying anymore. You got to put a bullet through somebody's heart. So some guy's crying and has a knife, is threatening suicide, kill him. Well, he had a knife. I was afraid. He reached for his waistband, which everybody knows is where people keep their waistband, but it's also where sometimes they might could keep a gun. And so, yeah, no, I didn't see a gun because there was no gun, but waistband. Look, everybody, waistband. Rally Balco had one today about a guy who was sentenced to death for killing a cop. And the reason that he was convicted, one of the reasons he was convicted, is because the foreman of the grand jury was himself a cop. And he threatened to kidnap, to have the state come and protect her children if she testified as the accused's alibi witness. So, sorry, Charlie. I can't testify on your behalf because they're going to steal my kids, she said. What can I do? The foreman of the grand jury was a cop. Perfectly happy to let the real cop killer go free in order that they can nail the guy they want to nail and sentence him to death. And then, as Rally Balco is reporting today at the Washington Post, it's only because of heroic journalism by, I think, a columnist / investigative reporter for the Houston Chronicle that this guy has now been set free. Oh, but gotta love them cops, if you are one. And in fact, Balco even talks about how, yeah, no, they have a name for it. What is the name for it that he cites? Where the actual policy is to stack the grand jury with government employees, with cops. Hang on, I'm going to find it for you here. I'm paging down my Twitter feed now. Boy, I tweet too much. Here we go. Balco's thing, and then page down in the Balco thing, and he says, the key man system. Remember that. The key man system. Chat room guys, later on, I'm going to forget that, and I'm going to need your help. The key man system. This was thanks to a grand jury selection system known as the key man system, which critics say allows judges and prosecutors to stack grand juries with people most likely to do the state's bidding. You know, this is something that has always fascinated me. You've heard me bring it up on the show before to guests, but it's something that when I think of it, I think of Robert Stack and watching Unsolved Mysteries from when I was a little kid, right? Or, you know, when those kind of shows first started coming out. So many stories. Just being a regular person watching TV, not being a libertarian with a confirmation bias and a reason to look at stories like these. That's one of the things that formed my thinking on this in the first place, I guess. So many stories my whole life long. Are you any different? Where cops frame up and prosecute innocent people for killing other cops. Isn't that crazy? Don't you think that they would want to make real sure that the guy who actually killed the cop, that he's the one that gets nailed to the wall? I mean, I guess it makes sense if they're just going to murder him in their off time anyway, and there's this other guy they hate and they want to frame him up. But I've just heard of so many cases where the guy's convicted of killing a cop and then it turned out he didn't do it. And I don't know what's the explanation for that. And there's got to be loyalty among the cops. Is it that their logic is that flawed that they're just purely inductive thinking and just if they can make a case, they make one? What is the case that we can make? What is a case that we can make and not what's true? Is that simply the answer? It's amazing to me. I never get over that. Here's one in the Washington Post this morning. And you think they care about the guy that, you know, killed somebody you care about. They're going to make sure to do a good job on that one. They don't do a good job when it's their own guy that gets killed. It seems like they're almost as likely to blame an innocent person. What do you mean you can prove you weren't there? Well, let's see. That could indicate, one, that I better go find the guy who actually did this and make sure he's the one who gets sentenced for it. Or, what can I do to destroy your alibi-providing witness here and prevent that from being proven in court? The mind of one of our security officers right there for you to step into and wander around for a little while. You know, and I know because I used to watch that show Law and Order some, and what always happens in Law and Order, the plot of every episode of Law and Order, right? And I never watched all the special victims, this and that crap. I got way over it before then, but the plot always is, man, it sure looks like Jenkins did it. Come on, let's get this guy Jenkins. You're under arrest. Blah, blah, blah. And then, oh my God, new evidence came to light. Forget it. Sorry. You know what? We're sorry. You're free to go. It turns out it was this other guy. Let's go get him. Come on. You think that's really how it is? That they're so happy to admit their mistake and turn around and get the right guy? Like they care. They don't care. They stay paid anyway. Anyway. Boy, people love them some government, though. Hey, come on. If the cops shot thousands and thousands and thousands of people, that's the proof that they must have needed to. That they had no choice to. Otherwise, why would it happen? What do you mean Saddam didn't do 9/11? Or else, why would we be attacking him then, you idiot? They chant. Same thing here. Anyway, sorry, I was going to cover the ISIS war more and stuff, but now I got to go. Sandy Tola next on the show. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Next up on the show is Sandy Tolan. Oh boy, I'm on the wrong tab too, aren't I? Well, I'll tell you, I think it's fair to say, Sandy, as I troll through my tabs here looking for my use section. Here it is. People may well have read you before at TomDispatch.com. Is that correct?
That's right.
Right.
A number of other places, Salon, Daily Beast, other places as well.
There you go. And then you're the author of the books The Lemon Tree and Children of the Stone, The Power of Music in a Hard Land. That's the newest one, right?
That's correct. Just came out in April.
Okay. Now, the URL here is kind of a pain, so I'll tell you, just Google up Sandy and Musical Intifada for this article, A Musical Intifada in the West Bank. So just Google Musical Intifada and Sandy, and it'll come right up for you here. And this is a very interesting story, well, of the West Bank and the occupation, the larger politics, but also, of course, of this young girl. What's her name? I don't know how to say it right, so I'll let you. And please introduce her and her story.
Okay. Ala Shalalda is the girl on the cover of the book. She's now 17. I think I met her when she was 12 or 13. She is Palestinian musician, a violinist who was one of the first students at the music school that I document, founded by a young stone thrower of the first Palestinian Intifada, who was iconized. His iconic image of the first Intifada was captured in late 1987, throwing stones at his Israeli soldiers. He then went on to become very good at music, found a music school. And Ala, the girl that you were asking me about, is on the cover of the book. But the story I tell really throughout the book and in this article is of the times that she was, you know, at times she has been forced to stop at checkpoints, as every young and old Palestinian need to do. There are hundreds of them throughout the West Bank. And at one point, when she was coming back from a concert and she was forced to play the violin for a soldier. And it's those kinds of experiences that children throughout Palestine in this music school experience, just as other Palestinians do on a daily basis. Hundreds of checkpoints in a land the size of Delaware. So the book is a story about music, but it's also a story about resilience and strength and a kind of nonviolent confrontation of the occupation on the part of Ramzi, the founder of the music school, and girls and kids like Allah and these wonderful young Palestinian musicians.
Mm-hmm. And now tell the story of her being forced to play the violin for the IDF there.
Yeah, well, it was this particular incident was, I believe, in April of 2008. And you have to bear in mind, Scott, I mean, it's interesting that we're speaking on June 10th. This is the 48th anniversary of the end of the so-called Six-Day War, also known as the 1967 War, and also known as the beginning of the occupation by Israel of the West Bank and Gaza. And it's these children who really don't know, and really anyone under 50 who hasn't had the opportunity to travel outside of Palestine, they don't know anything but occupation. So in a way, I mean, I describe this in the book, and one of my chapters opens with Allah and her older sister, who's a flutist, and some of the other kids coming back from a concert to Ramallah, and they're stopped at a checkpoint. It's called a flying checkpoint, one of 600 of these so-called closure obstacles. And the soldier walks up and slides open the door and says, you know, he points at her blue violin case and said, "What's that?" And she said, "It's a violin." And he said, "Do you know how to play?" And she says, "Yes." He said, "Well, step out of the van." And he says, "I want you to play for me." And his sister's yelling, "Don't play for him." But she stood up and pulled out her violin and started playing this beautiful Arabic song called El Hawadi, which means the beautiful girl. And it was really quite a powerful moment. And actually, I was just in the West Bank. She's now 17. And as I read that incident, from my book, she came on stage and actually played that same song live. It was quite moving. But during that time, you know, in 2008, I believe it was, little did she or any of the other kids know that after she played, one of the other soldiers came up and was a bit more friendly and said, "You know, I play the violin too. Could I just borrow your violin for a minute?" And another soldier came and they actually started playing for the kids, with the kids' own instruments. And these Palestinian children were sort of astonished at, how could they be so mean to us on one hand and keep us under occupation and then, in this moment, seem like normal people. And Arasha, I remember telling me that she was genuinely confused by this. But
let me ask you.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm sure it's the same story. Maybe I misunderstood it the first time or just now the second time or I don't know what. But can you clarify a little bit about, I guess it seemed like I thought that the original incident there was, you know, a much more humiliating type of a thing. Are you saying that they really humiliated her and made her play, but then the other soldier came over and and he was kind of nice? Or you're saying the original demand was not so bad in the first place?
No, I'm saying the first thing. I mean, it was
what I thought it was. This was like a real, I mean, this is a 13-year-old girl and this is an armed soldier with an American, you know, machine gun in his hand.
Absolutely.
Saying play for me in a, you know, humiliating her in a terrible kind of a way.
Right. The last part of what happened was a very rare, and kind of exceptionally, unusual, incident. What happened,
which doesn't take away from the first part at all, right? That's just it almost makes it more of a humiliation that, like, oh, here, it's all harmless. Let me play your own violin for you now.
Well, the fact is that the real meaning of you know, there's this sort of a double meaning in this incident because of this one small act of kindness. But the fact is, the message that all Palestinians get at all times when they're traveling under severe restrictions in the West Bank is one of humiliation and domination. That is the central aspect of Israel's military occupation. There was an incident that was just documented by B'Tselem, the premier and very well respected human rights group in Israel, that documented the arrival of settlers at a swimming pool maintained by Palestinians in their own village, accompanied by soldiers who evicted the 70 or so Palestinians bathing in the pool to allow the settlers to bathe in the pool.
Right.
This is the kind of daily humiliation that unfortunately not only characterizes the occupation, but is more or less out of the view of most Americans. I think if Americans really understood what was happening, we probably wouldn't put up with it as much as and allow tax dollars to go toward it. The central reality of the occupation is humiliation, yeah. And it really can't stand. Eventually, it has to fall under the weight of its own sort of moral decay.
Well, and you think of the timing of this story of the pool here, where this is just a few days after the incident in McKinney, Texas, where the cops came and the one cop especially completely flipped out and went after her and tackled the young black girl and all that. And it's echoes of the old Jim Crow South that, you know, things certainly aren't perfect here, but they're better than that. And I think we're proud that we don't have KKK segregated swimming pools in America now, this kind of thing. And then here comes this exact kind of thing that we're proud to be over here being implemented right in front of our face there in Palestine on our dime, too. And I'm sorry we got to go to this break. We'll be right back with Sandy Tolan in just a minute. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Sandy Tolan about everyday life for occupied Palestinians and by way of telling the story of this young girl, Alaa, a musician, a violinist. And we're talking about the story of her being humiliated and forced to play the violin for IDF soldiers at a checkpoint. And then Sandy was mentioning this story from, I guess it's yesterday. It was during April, but the story just came out.
It was documented by B'Tselem, the human rights group, and I think their report came out more recently. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a write-up at Mondo Weiss about it today. Soldiers expel 200 Palestinians from pool to allow settlers to bathe instead. You know, amazing stuff. And, you know, I know you're not supposed to ever bring up Hitler or the Nazis because there's a rule against that and whatever. But, you know, the war didn't really start until 39, right? And the Nazis were in power in Germany and humiliating a lot of Jews and a lot of other people and mistreating them in a lot of ways, you know, long before the war and the Holocaust ever broke out. And this sounds exactly like the violin story sounds exactly like the kind of anecdote that I heard as a kid about how people were treated, especially Jews, under the Nazis, where this kind of routine humiliation of a child just because they're the SS and what are you going to do about it? And that's how they are. And, you know, I've heard also many stories of people in the Soviet Union. I'm not talking about the world's worst pogrom or the final solution, but just day-to-day anti-Semitism on the part of, you know, all the various different kinds of secret police and public ones under the USSR, who treated Jews and others in this exact same kind of way. And this is all sponsored by the American people. that you know, this kind of treatment of even kids.
I want to intervene here. Look, I don't find those kind of historical analogies that useful to compare Israelis to Nazis. I think you should look at it. I mean, look, other people have pointed out that these kinds of musical performances were also required of people in the concentration camps. But beyond that, I think this calling Israelis Nazis is using a label instead of describing the specific.
Well, I'm not, though. I'm just talking about the event, right? And I'm thinking more of like, show me your papers at the train station type transgression rather than, again, the Holocaust. I wasn't comparing it to the Final Solution. I was comparing it to ritual humiliation on the part of unaccountable government officials.
Right. So let's just call it what it is rather than saying it echoes this. I mean, that's my own opinion.
Okay, but I'm just admitting that it does, because that's how I was raised to think about World War II, was this is how Nazis behave and this is why we fought them kind of thing. That's my experience in going to government school in America. Why we're the good guys, because we fight people who do things like this.
Right. So my preference is to look at exactly what's happening. Like, I know a lot of people don't like the labels of apartheid but if you look at what's actually happening on the ground, you have to judge it on its own terms, which is separate and unequal treatment, and the humiliation, whatever its historical echoes, the humiliation and the degradation and the complete lack of freedom that is forced upon the Palestinians speaks on its own terms. And as Americans, we're supporting this through our tax dollars. And as I said before, I don't think that this can abide. This is a system of such deep injustice that I think the more it's exposed on its own terms for what it is, which is separate and unequal, which does carry echoes of apartheid, according to Desmond Tutu, the Nobel Prize winning Archbishop of South Africa. It does carry echoes of Jim Crow. When you look at this pool incident we've been discussing, Scott, and when you look at, you know, you compare that to what just happened in Texas, where, you know, a state still tinged with the Confederacy. It's hard to ignore some of these historical parallels. I agree. I think, you know, evoking Nazism in Israel is not a way to advance the conversation, though.
Well, right. I mean, that's the thing. It's whatever his name's law, that you're never allowed to talk about how national socialism could apply in a historical analogy. It's the one history we're not supposed to learn from, because it's like the argument ad absurdum, right? Because, hey, it was a totalitarian government, so they were for everything. So you can compare anything to their policies, basically, right?
I don't think
I'm being absurd in saying that this is the kind of thing that Nazi cops would have done to people at the train station for their own entertainment at the average civilian's expense and that kind of thing. It's exactly
right.
That kind of anecdote, you know?
I personally don't think it's useful to compare Israelis to Nazis.
All right. Well, how about... you know, my wife grew up in the Soviet Union. She's Jewish, and she was treated, again, not like it was in the middle of World War II in the Final Solution or anything like that, but her and her family were treated as third or fourth class citizens in the USSR and made to undergo just these kinds of humiliations. Is it okay if I compare them to the...
Well, it's okay. You can do whatever you want. I'm just
saying... South Africa is a good one, but never Germany. I understand, but it just seems kind of silly when you put it in context of... You can compare them to any other totalitarian government, but not the German one.
Scott, we don't have to agree on everything.
All right, I got you. Anyway. So, but now, tell me the story of how she went back and went ahead and in a non-humiliating way kind of bested them by playing and going and doing a concert at the checkpoint for the people there.
Well,
and showing the IDF up.
So what? One of the things that I write about in my book, in Children of the Stone, what I really wanted to do probably more than anything is show what everyday life is for Palestinians, especially Palestinian children, under a system of occupation that is getting close to its half-century mark. But I wanted to do it through the drama of this music school and by showing what children, how their lives really can be transformed. I mean, you still have the sort of concrete confinement of the occupation, over their lives, and that's unavoidable. But within these chains, so to speak, you have children who are becoming not only more resilient and stronger, but begin to see themselves in a different way. Allah, you know, when she was playing that song for that soldier, was doing it with such sort of pride and defiance, and her big sister was so proud of her. But it's not just this moment. Her big sister is named Rasha, and she plays the flute. And she described to me in really eloquent terms about how much she was really transformed in her interior, not just in the sense of the moment that she's playing the music, but how she began to see herself differently. She began to see herself as not so much an angry child who had been so devastated and traumatized by the second Palestinian Intifada, which was much more violent than the first, but by the fact that she saw herself as a resilient, self-respecting musician. And this is how her teachers and her family began to see her. And then I started doing some research into how music affects children in other war zones, in places like Bosnia, South Africa under apartheid, in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. You know, research had been done by brain scientists and neurologists and musicologists and others that show that you know, your inner wiring can change, that this really ends up transforming children. So that's a lot about the book, is this strength, self-respect, and not just a sort of kumbaya story where, oh, isn't it nice that these little children have put down their stones and are picking up musical instruments? I mean, that on the surface is true, but also just as true, or maybe more true, is the fact that they're using this music as a form of resistance against the occupation and a nonviolent confrontation to the soldiers. One of the most amazing experiences I've ever had is seeing Allah and a bunch of other young Palestinian musicians march into one of the bleakest places on earth, the Kalandia checkpoint that separates Ramallah and Jerusalem. And to the shock of the soldiers, set up their music stands and begin to perform Mozart's Symphony No. 6. I have never seen anything like it. It was one of the most amazing moments in my life as a journalist.
Yeah. Well, and it is. It's important just to see that, you know, they're surviving and declaring their humanity under that occupation, and despite
exactly. It,
that you can cage them like animals, but that doesn't turn them into animals. They're not, and that kind of behavior just toward them is simply not justified. And I'm sorry we're out of time. I'm sorry for the big argument. I'm just been out of shape.
No, it's not. It's not. It's anyway. Cool. I don't, we don't have to agree on everything.
Yeah, no, that's all right. All right, so thanks very much for your time, Sandy. Great to have you again.
Okay.
All right, y'all, that's Sandy Tolan. And he is the author of The Lemon Tree, An Arab, a Jew, and the Heart of the Middle East. And you can find this great article, A Musical Intifada in the West Bank. The URL is a pain, but just Google Sandy and A Musical Intifada. It'll come right up for you. And that's the show today. Thanks. See y'all.